What I'm basically going to try to discuss today is some techniques that I've developed to deal with, obviously, a very generic problem. How do you diagonalize the Hamiltonian for a quantum mechanical system? How do you construct the eigenstates? Sometimes these you think of these as sort of out there, not very accessible, but what I've basically done is to produce a convergent way of accessing eigenvalues and eigenfunctions, at least under suitable systems. In this case, I'm looking at a system which is many-body localized. So it's possible to give a complete diagonalization of the Hamiltonian and construct the eigenstates. So along the way, this is a perturbatively accessible regime, but as you know, in physics, perturbation expansions rarely converge. So there's always the question of can the insight you get from the first couple of terms in the perturbation theory, are those really reflected in the true phenomenon? And so by analyzing why the perturbation theory fails to converge, and then adjusting, do some resummations, or basically doing some end runs around those lack of convergences, we can understand more fully exactly what's going on and what are the interesting phenomena in these systems. So this is a recent paper which posted on the archive a month or so ago. We're taking a one-dimensional spin chain, and with random local interactions, this is not going to be a complete proof of localization because there's one fundamental assumption I need to make, which has to do with the level statistics, that they don't sort of become, go into this sort of unphysical level attracting regime. But modulo that assumption, everything I do is rigorous. The construction uses a sequence of local unitary transformations to diagonalize the Hamiltonian and construct the many-body eigenfunctions. So this gives you a very concrete way of generating these conserved quantities, these extensive conserved quantities, which have been discussed a number of times in this meeting. These ideas, I've been working on this problem for quite some time, I guess 4 years. mostly with Tom Spencer and also many conversations with David Hughes. So I'm very happy to be able to present them to you today. So the basic issue is, does localization persist in a more realistic model with interacting particles? So localization is extremely well understood when you consider one-body systems. That's the traditional Anderson localization. There's tons and tons of mathematical results, and this is a very well understood problem. But the role of interactions in localization, whether localization persists in the presence of interactions, this has been a touchy subject for many years. I mean, it was originally, Anderson 58 paper discusses, at least initially, the many-body problem, but then quickly works on the one-body problem. And then a number of years later, with Anderson, there was some further discussion of the role of interactions. And a number of other authors, and then this BAA paper, which is sort of gives a very lengthy and extensive argument based upon this Cayley tree picture. And then recent works, Powell and Hughes specifically, with the numerics and further connections of this to the idea of thermalization and so basically, I'm going to try to add to this list here by putting the idea of many-body localization on a much firmer ground. And although we still have this assumption, basically it reduces the idea of any bilocalization to this physically reasonable assumption on level statistics, which would be hard to dispute, really. I'm going to take a specific model, which is similar to some of the models that have been discussed. I'm going to primarily be working in the Z basis. So we have the random field term and the exchange term here. And then the perturbation is going to be this X term. One thing that I'm doing, which is a variation on what we've seen before, is that I'm making all three of these coefficients be random. And the reason for that is the more random is in the system, the easier it is for me to deal with this question of level statistics, and which ultimately is connected to resonance probabilities. The basic idea is we're trying to treat the idea of many bilocalization as a diagonal perturbation, trying to remove the interaction terms which are off diagonal. Actually, that's a very traditional, the basic problem in all perturbation theory in quantum mechanics is perturbation in the off diagonal elements. The small parameter here is going to be this gamma. Otherwise, we're just going to assume everything is a nice continuous distribution, bounded random variables. Now, let me get more specifically to this assumption on level statistics. I'll call it LLA, or limited level attraction. We're saying we're interested in the probability that in a system, in some box of size n, normally you'd say that if you have a system, a box of size n, you have a spin chain, there should be 2 to the n levels, so the level spacing should be 2 to the minus n, roughly speaking. But there may be atypically small level spacing, so we're going to look at the minimum over all the energy levels in that box. That's the probability that it's smaller than delta. It should go with some power of delta times some constant to the n. So if you have the system, let's take, for example, nu equals 1, which would be the Poisson case. The probability, and we can take delta to be something like 2 to the minus n or 5 to the minus n or something like that. Then the probability that it's less than delta would go like delta, which would be an exponential in n. That would beat this constant to the n. So you get some probability which goes to 0 exponentially with n. So even with Poisson statistics, the probability of getting an atypically small level separation is going to go to 0 exponentially in n. And if you go to other statistics, like, you know, if you're actually in a delocalized phase, you might expect to see GOE statistics, and then that would correspond to nu bigger than 1. And so then the probabilities would actually go to 0 faster. So the unphysical case is where nu is less than 1. That corresponds to level attraction. So if levels are closer together than the Poisson case. And so what I'm saying here is that I can handle any value of nu. Take, say, a half or a quarter or something like that. And then as long as my small parameter is small enough, then we can prove many-body localization. That's the basic assumption. By the way, you know, when do systems exhibit level attraction? I mean, it's a very uncommon phenomenon, but the problem is you can't rule it out because even if you have, say, a system of 4 levels, you're going to always have some kind of level repulsion. But what happens is that, let's say, the middle levels may have a very weak repulsion. Maybe the matrix element is very small. And then due to the level repulsion from the upper and lower pairs, that would basically push those two levels in the middle together and create an enormously small level separation. So, you know, but why should you have atypically small matrix elements? That sort of shifts the problem to a different area. You don't really expect that, but it's just not something that I can prove rigorously at the moment. Yes? It's about the full Hamiltonian, yeah. It's because this is easy to show for the unperturbed Hamiltonian, which has, you can see that it has Poisson statistics. Yes? Right.
So if I have like probability one, just one such pair of levels, it's already bad for you? That's what they find hard.
Yeah, no, but I mean, physically, you know, this is a real problem. I mean, in fact, if you do have those, it's not just that my proof would fail, but under that circumstance with extremely tiny levels, then you would expect many bilocalization to fail. So it's correct that my proof doesn't work in that example. Basically, when you have extremely tiny level spacings, it means you have to go to enormous distances you're always fighting resonance probabilities with exponential decay in the localization game. So when you have tiny energy level distances, that means you have to go to enormous distance to beat that. So as this goes to zero, distance goes to infinity, and eventually you're just basically in a regime where spins are talking to all the other spins in the system, and you're going to get thermalization. Of course, you know, maybe this would be at some really, a length scale greater than the length size of the universe, something like that. But at least at a mathematical level, the existence of these tiny levels would spoil the localization property.
So in a model with a continuous symmetry where I generically expect level crossings, there's no hope.
Probably not. I mean, I'm not sure I understand why you would expect level crossings, but. I mean, generally, you don't see level crossings unless you really have a system decoupling into two independent systems. And then you would have to talk about the property of localization in the two subsystems or something like that. Okay. So let's grant ourselves this assumption on the level statistics. Then. What can we prove? And I just try to give these, state most of these results in words. First of all, there's a labeling system for eigenstates by spin metaspin configurations. So let's ignore the metaspins for a second. The whole idea here is that you want to basically identify each eigenstate of the Hamiltonian by this. The classical spin configuration that it corresponds to. If you could step back a moment to the one-body problem, each eigenstate has a localization center, basically. And so there's more or less a one-to-one mapping between points of the lattice and eigenstates. If we step back to the many-body situation, each eigenstate, at least in the many-body localized regime, you could think that there's one eigenstate corresponding to each classical spin configuration of the problem. And just as in the one-body problem, you get some spreading, exponential spreading about that localization center. Of course, the eigenstates are going to have some weight on nearby spin configurations, but they're going to be identifiable as having come from a particular spin configuration. Yes?
So this level means that you have like an adiabatic path. When you add the perturbations
Well, I guess I don't actually use an adiabatic deformation from one to the other, but I suppose you could you construct that. I guess.
But does it imply that?
No, I don't think it immediately implies it, but it's possible that using similar methods, one could move adiabatically from one to the other.
Well, do you mean adiabatically in this case?
Well, if you start like with some classical space configuration, and then at the time of motion, you adiabatically turn on the extra gamma term that you made, then it will just move.
But there are a lot of level crossings, right?
Yeah, but then they're not important. That's what.
If yeah,
some of them are important, right?
Well, if you have an edge, I don't know.
Well, you know, the issue is that if you're going to do a one-parameter family, the question is whether these resonances somehow, they shift around as you vary that parameter, and whether you can somehow take a soup over that one-parameter family and... which I think probably you can, but I haven't thought about it too carefully. In other words, you could define the resonant regions to be the union of all the resonant regions that you would come across as you varied from 0 to 1. And so those resonant regions might be slightly larger than the ones that I work with, but still relatively small. So let's talk about these resonant blocks. Naturally, you're going to have regions where this resonance is, and this picture of mapping the eigenstates to the classical spin configuration is going to break down. And this happens even in the one-body problem. But so then you have to sort of throw up your hand and say, well, there's a resonant region. I can define a one-to-one correspondence, but it's somewhat arbitrary. So instead, what I do is I say, if I have a resonant region, I just call it a metaspin. If the resonant region has size n, then there are 2 to the n values that the metaspin can take. So when I diagonalize that subsystem, I have 2 to the n levels, and that's basically the metaspin variable for that resonant region. So then we have we're labeling our eigenstates most through a spin metaspin configuration, where in some regions of space where it's sufficient to work with spin configurations, classical spin configurations, in these dilute regions, you have this mixing around and you have to use metaspin labels. All right, so now
that those metaspins, it's local.
Yeah, right. So you have maybe the picture would be in order here. So we have these spins, and then there's some resonant region here. So in this case, there's 4 spins that are swamped up in this resonant region. So there's going to be 2 to the 4 metaspin values, whereas all the everywhere else, we just have 2 values. And so if I'm going to label an eigenstate, I just label each of these spins as being up or down. And then this metaspin, I label it as being one of these 2 two to the fourth possible values.
But do you have rare regions where 4 is very long?
Yes. I mean, this can be arbitrarily long. But the key is that we have faster than power law decay of the probability of resonant blocks, which gives you then the diluteness. And in fact, if you didn't have this some kind of control on these probabilities, it would just spoil the whole notion of labeling system. It would mean that basically these resonant blocks are percolating, and so then you wouldn't really be doing anything other than just saying, well, there exists a way of diagonalizing the Hamiltonian without saying anything about that diagonalization. Okay, so then Hamiltonian is diagonalized via a sequence of local rotations. That's the rotations which only affect spins in a finite region, defined via convergent graphical expansions with exponential bounds.
So local means strictly local, or exponential tails?
Well, I'm doing a whole sequence of transformations. So I start with the short range ones. They're all strictly local, but eventually they get to be larger and larger and larger. So after constructing all the eigenstates and the eigenvalues, then we want to know something about their properties. So one nice property is that if you compute expectations of local observables in an eigenstate, it's going to be close to the naive value, which is what you would get just by inserting the classical spin configuration. So for example, if you look at, and this is something that we saw in the last talk, let's say you take the expectation of the spin at the origin in some eigenstate alpha. Assuming this is not in a resonant region, if the origin is not in a resonant region, then this is going to be plus 1 or minus 1 in the classical configuration. And the true expectation will then be close to plus 1 or close to minus 1, depending upon what the labeling spin configuration is. There's some notion of convergence as the box goes to infinity. Of course, we need uniform bounds. Local energy differences, that is, if you make, let's say you take this labeling configuration and flip one spin or a handful of spins, then you get an energy difference. And that's going to converge as the box goes to infinity. And then you have also expectations will converge. And then if you look at truncated expectations or connected correlations in an eigenstate, you're going to see exponential decay for that. And you can take the averaged truncated expectation as well, and then you'll see this faster than parallel decay, which comes from the prime dominated by the probability of resonant regions.
What is truncated expectation?
That would just be, actually it's in the next slide, I guess. Just the correlation minus the product of the expectations.
So that's the definition for
of truncated, yeah. So at the level of a theorem, then, this is what we, this, at least for certain of those discussion points, we assume LLA for some fixed nu in C, and then there's some kappa, and then the key thing is that gamma has to be sufficiently small depending upon what those values were. The expectation, well, here I took a particular way, I took the absolute value of the spin expectation at the origin. So then it's going to be close to 1 in for most of the time. And then there's going to be corrections, which are some power of gamma after taking the expectation. Then we have the decay of correlations here, and then also in the average decay of the expected correlations. This average here is just some way of you can either take, for example, a uniform weighting on all eigenstates, or you could take some temperature e to the minus beta e. Basically, we have a result for all eigenstates, so it doesn't really matter how you average them. So what are the consequences? You don't have thermalization. So one quick way to see that is to go to infinite temperature, and so then this will be a uniform weighting. And so then nothing should depend upon the energy. So this, if you had thermalization, the expectation of a spin at the origin would be 0. But of course, we just showed that it's decidedly non-zero. It's close to 1, so that violates thermalization. And then you can talk about transport properties, but you know, essentially, all these eigenstates are going to have a non-uniform distribution of energy. I mean, you could explicitly choose a labeling set of states with energy high over here and low over here. And of course, the eigenstates live for all time. So then this excess of energy to the left is not going to be transported to the right. So you don't have transport in that sense. Okay, so as I said, I think that what I really like to do is to explain to you, give you some ideas about what's behind this expansion and what are some of the physical mechanisms that I needed to overcome in order to get convergence. What we're going to do is basically a KM type procedure. That is, in KM, you define a canonical transformation which approximately gives you something integrable. Likewise, here, we're going to define an approximate diagonalization and see what we get after we've applied that. And then if you, what we'll see is that the off-diagonal parts of the Hamiltonian are going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. And as in KM or in Newton's method, you could basically, if the off-diagonal element is J, then after doing first-order perturbation theory, the new off-diagonal term will be of order J squared. And then you repeat, it's going to be of order J to the fourth. And so you're going to have this rapid decrease of the size of off-diagonal elements of the matrix. And although, and this is done sort of in tandem to a sequence of length scales, which is basically 2 to the k, but there has to be some adjustment for reasons we'll get into later. And so then the off-diagonal elements are basically going to be of order gamma to the m, where m is in this range between lk to lk plus 1. So we see this sort of quadratic or nearly quadratic convergence property that you see in KM or Newton's method. And it makes perfect sense that these KM should be tied to the length scale, because when you go to nth order perturbation theory, that corresponds to hopping a distance n, right? So if you're limiting the order of perturbation theory, that corresponds to a limit on the length that you can reach within that order of perturbation theory. We get a convergent power series for the orthogonal rotations that accomplish this each of these sequence of diagonals of rotations. Then what happens when you have resonant region? Well, you see this as, you know, you're not going to, as in KM, you're not going to have be able to do this everywhere. But here's an actual distinction from KM, because in KM, there are these chaotic regions where you say, I can't deal with those. But here, we don't have the freedom to do that. We want to get a complete diagonalization of the Hamiltonian. So when we have resonances, that's going to be a barrier to doing the perturbation theory at some step k. But then at some later step, we have to return to that region and try to do some larger block diagonalization. So basically what this means is that when we have a block, one of these resonant blocks, we have 2 to the 4 states. It's like in quasi-degenerate perturbation theory. These guys, we have to think of them as being very degenerate levels, and the other levels are well separated from those. So we diagonalize explicitly, or not explicitly, depending on your point of view. There is always exists some way of diagonalizing this 16 by 16 matrix. And that way we know exactly where these levels are. And then at some much larger length scale, such that the couplings are much smaller than the level spacing in this block, then I can revisit the question of whether this thing is connected to some distant region. Some references here. I do have this paper, which I keep putting it off, but it's on my website. which does all this, these diagonalization procedures for the one-body Anderson model. This was sort of a warm-up problem to develop the methods. And certainly it might be, if somebody's interested in reading up on these things, that might be a good intro to look at that.
So what about it? I mean, you have a precise definition of when you hit a resonant block. This is one.
Yes. Right.
What's the condition?
Here we go. Anticipating your question. Here I'm talking about the first step. Okay, when we're just talking about nearest neighbor resonances. So you're just basically looking at individual spin flips. So what happens? You get this, a spin configuration sigma is changed to a flipped spin configuration where one spin is different. What's the energy change? Well, you get the magnetic term and then the exchange term for the nearest neighbors. There are four possible values for those two nearest neighbor spins. So there's four energy differences you have to be worried about. And you say that's a resonant site if any of those four energy changes is small. How small? We choose a small power of the coupling constant as our desideratum for whether it's small or not.
This one is arbitrary, or?
It's just some number that I. That's complicated. Yeah, it was just some number I picked to optimize in the proof. But in some sense, you might do better by letting this number get closer to gamma. But it's a trade-off between resonance probabilities and graphical probabilities. All the graphs, if you have an energy denominator, this is actually a useful point. If you have an energy denominator epsilon, and the graph, the coupling constant, is gamma, then the graphs are going to be basically decay like this to the n for length n. Because the graph is going to be a coupling off-diagonal term divided by energy denominator. So if epsilon is a power of gamma, a small power of gamma, this is decaying very nicely. But then the probabilities are going to behave like epsilon to the n. So there's a trade-off between, how tight I make the resonance conditions. That affects the probabilities, and it affects the graph sizes of the graphs. Epsilon should be some power of gamma between 0 and 1 based on that criteria. Yeah.
Another question. So you say you were only worried about local single spin flip resonance. But I could have a spin flip here that is not resonant.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, that would be.
You'll take care of later.
Right. So resonances between distance spin pairs will be taken care of when the LK, the current length scale, is that length. Because in fact, although those two things may appear at the bare level to be very resonant, you really wouldn't know if they were resonant to the desired degree of accuracy. Unless you would include perturbative corrections to the energies on all the length scales up to that length scale. So it's not just that I'm doing this sort of for convenience. I'm actually required. There really would be no point in defining resonances at longer length scales until I have a appropriately accurate measure of what the energies I'm working with are. Okay. Question, yeah.
This power one of n doesn't imply that it goes to bigger distances, or basically with probability to add one, you will see resonances. It looks like if you go larger and larger, maybe the resonances go down
Well,
I'm just curious because the fact that this power is much smaller than one.
Yeah, no, it's really, it's best to look at this. You see, this epsilon is basically a fixed number. And so when you look at things that happen at much longer length scales, you get powers of epsilon as well as powers of gamma. And so therefore, the ratio is going to be small, and this is going to be small. The probabilities of resonances, of course, need to go down exponentially. That's because ultimately, this is you have a resonance probability, but you have to fight the number of possible states. And here already we had four possible states that I had to compute the resonance for, right? And so when the range of the interaction gets longer and longer, and we have larger and larger resonance blocks, you always have exponentials in L for the number of states you have to check for resonances. So of course the probabilities have to go down exponentially. Okay, so then the basic step is simple perturbation theory. You take the off-diagonal part of the Hamiltonian and write as a resonant part and a perturbative part. The resonant part contains terms that are internal to the resonant blocks. So the resonant blocks, as I said, at least at the first level, we just take all the sites that are resonant, I group them up into connected components, and those are the resonant blocks. So you have internal couplings, and you have all the rest. And so what we're going to do is we're going to define this generator for a rotation, which is, as in Rayleigh-Schrodinger perturbation theory, you just take the off-diagonal term divided by the energy difference. Then we use the exponential for this just to make sure we preserve norm. So omega is e to the minus a, and we do this rotation on the Hamiltonian. Then there's some algebra that goes into this. Some of you may be familiar with this, but basically the whole point behind this Rayleigh-Schrodinger perturbation theory is that when you commute this generator with the diagonal part of the Hamiltonian, you get minus the interaction. Which is easily to verify. So then if you compute the commutator with the full Hamiltonian, you get minus the interaction plus basically the new interaction, the commutator of A with the off-diagonal piece. So realizing that A had the interaction in it, this is really of order J squared, right? So you're going from first order interaction to second to quadratic, yes? Yes. Well, it's a special case, I guess, yeah. All any orthogonal matrix is unitary, just it just so happened we're happy to have a real Hamiltonian, so you can work with because there's no sigma y. So
so you have transforming e to the a, and what is the condition on a?
The definition of it's actually anisymmetric, but since we're in this real case.
So this also preserves the eigenvalues.
Yes, of course, yeah. So the commutator is basically going to cancel the off-diagonal piece and replace it with one which is basically of order J squared. So if you work this out, the new Hamiltonian, the rotation, we have the old Hamiltonian plus this series of commutators. And as promised, these two pieces cancel. And we're left with the resonant part remains. And then we have commutators of A with the interaction. So all these terms are of order J squared. Okay, so that basically that's the step that we do that to generate the local transformations, at least in the non-resident regions. So as I said, the perturbative piece is gone, the resident piece remains. The new interaction is quadratic or high order in gamma. And it contains terms involving multiple commutators of this A operator with J. And now the important thing is that this whole procedure, we have to preserve locality, right? So if I have a rotation corresponding to an off-diagonal term here at I, and another one corresponding to an off-diagonal term over here at J, they're going to, they don't involve any of the same spin variables, so they're going to commute as long as, actually they, you need I minus J bigger than one in order for them to commute. They don't commute for nearest neighbors because the energies, if we go back to the this picture here, the energies, you see, they depend upon the spin of nearest neighbor. So that's going to interfere with commutativity of these operations. So if I perform a spin flip on sigma I plus 1, and then I apply the A operator, or if I do it in the other order, you get a completely different answer. So you have non-commutativity for these nearest neighbor operators. And so that sort of, as the range of these operators gets larger and larger, this non-commutativity will also extend. We have to keep track of that. Okay, so now where we, so, J1 now, although I said it was quadratic and higher order in gamma, but it now actually has an infinite tail because of this whole power series in N is we're going off to infinity. but basically, we don't want to deal with interactions at a very long distance, so we're just going to leave those terms in the Hamiltonian until the length scale gets to the appropriate size. Then, you, of course, you have the resonant region, so we perform just an exact rotation in those resonant regions to diagonalize the Hamiltonian there. And then there's this other, this sort of slightly more technical issue of you can't diagonalize everywhere, but you only small regions can be dealt with at a given stage. You have a large region. You have a large region, you have 2 to the n states. You basically have to wait until the couplings are of order gamma to the n, so that you can fight the number of states with the size of the couplings. So these large ones will have to wait. The other one, the small ones, we diagonalize. Okay, so basically what I've done is I've described one step of the procedure, this, the very simplest step, the first one. Let's just see if we can prove some of the statements that we're interested in after the one step. Let's, for example, take the expectation of the spin at the origin. What we have are approximate eigenstates. So I'm going to just take the expectation in an approximate eigenstate after the first rotation. So I take the in the sigma basis, this is just basically given by the whatever label I'm at. Sigma is the state that I'm working in. So this, in that state, this operator is going to be either plus 1 or minus 1. It's going to be sigma 0. Then I rotate on either side, and that these rotations will produce a little bit of a tail, and it will it'll reduce that one to something slightly smaller than one. But anyway, it's going to be of order epsilon. That this epsilon comes from two effects. Either you're in a resonant region, the probability of a resonant region is of order epsilon, or you're not in a resonant region, and then The amount by which this is different from one is a perturbative amount, so it's of order gamma.
So what's the average of an average with respect to the disorder linearization, or with respect to the position, or
the average over alpha is the average over the eigenstates. So in any eigenstate, which I'm, I guess I should have used the same label here, but well, no, this is, that's confusing. No, sigma is a summation variable, yeah. Anyway, whatever the eigenstate is, it's going to specify some value for sigma at the origin, at least if I'm not in a dealing with the quasi, the metaspins. And that's either going to be plus or minus one, and then these rotations are basically not going to spoil that too much. Okay, so basically what I've done is I've proven this property to hold after the first step of the procedure. To obtain the theorem, we have to prove this for the complete diagonalization. So we have to keep repeating this operation of doing these rotations. Yeah?
So what's the typical size of the metaspin that you assume to have or get?
Well, at the moment, let's see, in the first step, of course, you only basically have metaspins, single spins. it just means that the up and the down configuration of that single spin can be resonant. And so, yeah, even for a single spin, of course, you can have a mixed state where this spin is, or a linear combination state where it's equally likely to be up and down. And so then, for those resonant spins, this expectation, this thing here will be near zero, let's say, and then the difference from one will not be small.
But I can imagine, so the size of the metaspin is actually related to the localization net, right? So if the localization net is two, then the typical size of the metaspin will be like two spins, right?
Oh, yeah, if you at a level of typical values, yeah. I mean, I'm taking this strong localization regime, so the localization length is basically one. Yeah. So at the level of typical values, all these resonances are going to be rare. You have faster than power law decay with the size of the resonant region. That doesn't mean you don't have to deal with larger resonant regions. By the way, you can do a similar rotation on the if you take a reduced density matrix when you're computing the entanglement entropy, then these rotations are basically, they're not going to affect the entanglement entropy unless they straddle the boundary between the subsystem and the full system. And so basically similar ideas will allow you to show that the entanglement entropy is bounded. Okay, preservation of exponential decay. This is going to be critical. If you look at, for example, kinetic correlations, there's going to be some graphs. If you look at the correlation between an operator at X and an operator at Y, there'll be some graphs. If the graphical terms that are near Y and the ones near X don't reach all the way across, then they're going to cancel out when you take the subtraction. So what's left are connected diagrams that going from X to Y. And these can be connections either through perturbative terms or through resonant blocks. And then when you take the expectation, you're going to get either smallness because the graphs are small or smallness because the resonant blocks have small probability. Or you can do it without taking the expectation, and then the diluteness of the resonant blocks will show that the decay from the graphs here, it gives you exponential decay overall for the correlation between X and Y. And likewise, it's important that the terms in the exponent, off-diagonal terms in the Hamiltonian, which are non-local, should have exponential decay. All right, so now we want to go through a sequence of length scales. We want to repeat this procedure. At each stage, we have an off-diagonal part of the Hamiltonian, which we call JK. It's a sum of graphs. Each of these graphs involves some transition from a state sigma to a state sigma tilde. And we have to define what it means to be resonant. But we're going to be doing basically a perturbation expansion in this A operator, which is the J over delta E, this Rayleigh-Schrodinger generator. So we just define, we say the graph is resonant if this thing is larger than some limit, which is gamma over epsilon to the length of the graph. So by the way, these energies have to get renormalized because this whole procedure only works for the off-diagonal matrix elements, right? Because obviously you can't take this energy denominator for a diagonal matrix element. So the off-diagonal pieces basically renormalize all the energies of the spin configuration. These are going to be non-local. And as I was mentioning earlier, it's important that we use these renormalized energies. Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense to talk about resonance to this degree of accuracy unless I knew these energies to the similar corresponding degree of accuracy.
Don't you have to sum over the graphs then?
Yes. Well, so this statement here, this definition here is for a resonant graph. And then, so what you're asking basically is how do I go from a collection of resonant graphs to a collection of resonant blocks, right? So if I have a, here's a resonant graph, here's a resonant graph, they maybe have some overlap, but I just take the connected components of these graphs and that gives me the resonant blocks. And then there's also distance conditions. When you take connected components, you have to use somewhat more complicated distance conditions, but maybe I better not go into that. We need to maintain uniform exponential decay on these probabilities because, as I mentioned earlier, you're always going to be fighting with exponentials coming from sums over states. So how does this work? Well, here's a potential problem. Just consider the simplest situation where now I've gone to step two. So this arch here represents an energy denominator in the first step, and this larger arch represents an energy denominator from the second step. These are two sites here. So if I flip this spin, I get an energy denominator. If I do a combined flip of these spins, I get this level two energy denominator. Now basically I have this scaling for the, depending upon the length of this arch, I get a corresponding power of epsilon for the energy denominator. But you see the powers don't match up because I get one power of epsilon from this and another power of epsilon from that. So this looks like gamma squared over epsilon cubed, which is not going to give me a uniform bound. And this is actually the key issue which one needs to deal with. These graphs are not uniformly bounded, but they do obey bounds in expectation. So if I take an expectation of this graph, then I'm basically integrating an energy denominator. So if I integrate 1 over E for that energy denominator, and then 1 over E prime for the other energy denominator, dE prime, well, it's not quite convergent, but if I take it to the S power, say S is 4/5, then this is going to be nicely convergent. So when I take the expectation, I get a number here, and I see no trace of this of these nasty powers of epsilon, which are screwing up the naive bound, which would be if I tried to do things uniformly, that is, you know, in soup norm. But once I got this bound in the expectation, then I can go back and get uniform bounds. I can say, what's the probability that this A is bigger than gamma over epsilon squared? Now, that's with the correct scaling of the power of epsilon with the power of gamma. And then it's going to be bounded by epsilon to the 2s, just from Markov's inequality. So by this little trick, we take a bad bound and convert it into a good one, good bound. The but at the there's a price to pay, of course, that there's always this gives a probability where things go bad. Then I have to add those bad regions to my resonant regions. So that's and in the end, that's defining what these resonant graphs are. You'll notice that this is starting to look like an exponential in the size of the graph. That's key for the procedure. We need to control exponentials in the size of the graph. How am I doing? Okay. All right. Now, in the k-scale, you get this sort of hierarchical structure where first, if here's something from the first level, the second level, third level, you have to deal with these commutativity diagrams, the extent to which this graph and that graph fail to commute. And that's sort of this is kind of the way the graphs look in higher levels. But maybe I shouldn't go into too much more detail there. So as I promised that I would discuss some of the difficulties with this procedure. One thing you see, and this is true even for the one-body problem, where you have problems with the graphs return to places they previously visited. Those are like loops. What happens when the graph returns, you get powers, k powers of this, if there are k returns, and then all of a sudden this nice Markov inequality, or this expectation no longer is finite. So you have to make a cut. You say, well, a graph is, if a graph has too many returns, I don't do this procedure. I have to use a separate procedure. I go back to these uniform bounds rather than probabilistic bounds. But I get a gain. When the graph returns, it sort of has much greater length compared to the distance traveled. And so that gives me sort of bonus decay, and it allows me to keep uniformity in all my estimates. Then there's this issue of large blocks and number divergence, which I alluded to earlier. This would be a picture, I guess, more appropriate for higher dimensions, but you have a resonant block. You have to put a collar neighborhood around it so that you don't consider interactions between the block and its immediate environment. Rather, you only allow interactions between the block and some a certain distance away. That's guaranteed so that the exponential decay from the outside into the block will beat the number of states inside the block. So in fact, this collar neighborhood has to be proportional to the size of the block. Then you have this issue of block-block residences, which is the trickiest part. But basically, we have an end run around this problem by having this level spacing assumption, which guarantees that you don't have too tiny energy differences here and there. And by the way, the residences are going to relate not so much to the energy differences themselves, but to how they fluctuate. And that's why we need all three terms in the Hamiltonian to be random, because then you have this direction in parameter space correspond to basically a global rescaling of the Hamiltonian. And that so if we have a spacing present in the system, we can make that spacing wiggle up and down and eliminate, at least probabilistically, resonances with other blocks. So let me just summarize then. To note the sources of divergences in perturbation theory, the most basic source of divergence comes from the fact that you have an energy denominator. You can't do perturbation theory when the states are too resonant. We deal with that by introducing a cutoff. Then there's more subtle notions of divergence in perturbation theory coming from the sum over scales. We need to be, make sure this procedure can run to all scales. The first way of dealing with that is by using this exponential or Newton's method scaling for the lengths. And this basically enables you to control the combinatorics of repeatedly inserting one expansion in, into another. And then we need bounds uniform in K. That comes from these fractional moment bounds on expectations. And then we have to, when that doesn't work, then we have to deal with the loops using the fact that you've got lots of returns and giving you bonus decay. So this is sort of the core of the method, is dealing with this uniformity over length scale. And finally, we have these number divergences from resonant regions, which are dealt with a collar. And of course, we have to make sure that these resonant regions don't percolate throughout space. So thanks, thanks for your attention. No, just one. Yeah, there's some issues coming from the fact that when you have there's a lack of independence. If I have a resonant graph which overlaps another one, they're not independent events, and so I can't just take the product of the probabilities. This isn't a problem in one dimension, but in higher dimensions, you can have this situation where you have a bunch of graphs, they're all overlapping at one point, they're all dependent variables. And so then I would just get diameter decay for such a region, whereas I really would need area decay, if I was in two dimensions, for the probability in order to run this procedure. So I'm not quite sure how to deal with that, but yes.
Do you have a bound on how strong the deterrent should be in the understanding in order to avoid
Well, you mean quantitative control on how small gamma has to be? Is that what you mean?
How small gamma or how small should be the order? Yes.
Gamma is the it's the off diagonal, but it's one over the disorder, I guess. So, no, I haven't tried to be quantitative about it because I was more interested in getting a reasonable exposition. So I would take shortcuts of taking squares or 20th powers of things when things became convenient.